Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have another inspiring founder that is joining us, you know, a founder that, you know, he's going to teach us a thing or two about dealing with the ups, the downs. You know, in this case, you know, like they started, you know, knocking on doors of VCs, you know, eventually they had the backs turned on them, then they got some traction, then they came back to them, and then other stuff like dealing with COVID and partnering with bigger players, you know, and now everything starts with maybe like a cease and desist, you know, stuff like that, like, so like really adrenaline filled, you know, type of experiences. Again, building, scaling, financing, all of that good stuff that we like to hear in those stories. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Andrew Blackmon. Welcome to the show.
All right. Thanks for having me, Alejandro. Great to meet you.
So originally born and raised in LA. So give us a walk through memory lane. How's life over there?
Yeah, one of the proud few born and raised in LA, not a transplant. I grew up in the Valley, which is about 20 minutes from the city center. It's a great place. Sunny, couldn't leave. I left for a little while, but for most of my life, I've been here.
And it's not like you went too far, because I mean, you went to Pepperdine, you know, there in Malibu, but you didn't study the typical, you know, stuff that founders would study, maybe business, economics, computer science, maybe law. I mean, you went into English literature. I mean, out of all things, why?
It's actually funny looking back on it, but at the time, all I knew was that I really loved to read and I loved philosophy and sort of classic literature. And I thought, this is what I'm going to study. This is what interests me. I need to kind of follow my heart and follow my interests. And so I did it. Towards the end of school, I started to realize this is very impractical. The only jobs people are hiring for are like teachers or then maybe somebody going to grad school. But honestly, at the end of the day, I really enjoyed it. And I like to hire people who have a kind of humanities background often because they're very well-rounded in my opinion.
I mean, one thing in your career too is like the 180 degrees. I mean, you go from literature, which is like super interesting. Then all of a sudden you find yourself doing law. I mean, IP law. I mean, what's going on with IP law?
Yeah. So my first job out of college was very fortuitous. It was basically a guy who had a connection to Pepperdine. We got along really well. He offered me a job doing kind of like marketing and just any assistant stuff. He had a big intellectual property law firm in Santa Monica. And so I owe this guy so much gratitude because it was my first gig. And I really got to see actually all the inventors and the entrepreneurs coming through because they needed protection for their ideas, their copyrights, trademarks, patents, et cetera. And to me, what I found out that it was very inspiring to me was the entrepreneurial side, not the law side. So I toyed with going to law school, took the LSAT, and thankfully I didn't get a very good score. So I didn't end up going, and that kind of catapulted me into going to business school instead, which was great.
Well, you know, eventually, you know, something really interesting happened here because you find yourself in Paris.
Exactly.
All of a sudden, you know, at what point do you realize that it's time to hit the reset button and maybe, you know, go back to school?
You know, I think I was so interested in business and in entrepreneurship and in venture capital, frankly, that I just didn't have the background of kind of knowledge to understand that world. Like if you would have told me $1 trillion of this, I would have no concept of what that really meant. And I had no concept of P&L, anything like that. So I decided, okay, I need to go to business school. This is a good path for me. I thought about going in LA or California, but I've been here my entire life. So I ended up going to Paris, which is a really interesting experience for me because I was surrounded by people from all different countries, all over the world. And I was probably the most green student given I didn't have a business background or didn't study economics or anything, like you said, in school. So for me, it was actually pretty hard. The coursework was challenging. This wasn't a walk in the park. But I really enjoyed it and really enjoyed the international experience, especially.
What do you think opened up for you? You know, the being outside of California for a little bit.
I mean, so at first it was kind of challenging, if I'm honest. I felt homesick. I'd been in California by the beach, surfing my whole life. And then I'm in the middle of Paris, kind of living in the city center, which is, you know, so populated. There's not a lot of nature and I'm very used to like going hiking and things like that. But after it was hard, it was really interesting. Like I met a ton of fascinating people. I think it really broadened my horizons in many ways, not just business, but personally. There was a lot of personal growth to live in a city that is so foreign to me. I didn't even really speak French when I first went there. And I went to a school that is primarily a French school, although their MBA program is in English. So it was like just kind of widening my aperture of what the world is in a major way, which is great.
And obviously it helped with shaping up a little bit more the way that you were thinking about business. So yep. I guess, you know, like, what were the sequence of events that needed to happen for you to, you know, bring the Black Tux to life?
Yeah, so my co-founder and I at the time, he was at NYU Business School, Stern, and I was finishing up business school in Paris. And these two schools were actually kind of sister schools. And so we threw around a bunch of ideas, and we were basically like, you know, we have complementary skill sets, let's start something together. And we had ideas of like in the food space, you know, we're pretty young at the time. I think we were 24. And then we had both rented suits and tuxedos a bunch of times for prom, weddings, things like that. And we thought, this is a really interesting industry. And so we did a bunch of research into the market, and we realized that the leading player in the space was a multi-billion dollar company. The rental part of their business was really profitable. And rentals in generally, to me, are a really good model because you can buy the inventory and rent it repeatedly over time, and you end up generating a lot of cash on the inventory that you originally purchased. And the more we dug into this, the more we became convinced, hey, if we start something that really kind of overhauls the entire suit and tuxedo rental industry, we'll be able to take some market share. So it really just kind of came from an idea. We were a little different than I think most entrepreneurs, or at least most that I see now, because now I like to invest in some businesses. You know, I get like a 10 to 20 page slide deck, which is all I want. When we, myself and Patrick, first started the business, we wrote like a 50 page business plan. And we thought through like every little detail. And if you read this thing now, which we have, it's like pretty hilarious because, you know, some of it ended up coming true, some of it didn't. But we were like very diligent with the idea. And I think to me, that was like the right way for me to start it, or for us to start it.
So what ended up being the business model? How are you guys, say, making money?
So business model is pretty simple. It started all online, but now we have a lot of stores. We have about 35 locations. But the concept is, if you need to rent or buy a suit or tuxedo for an event, usually it's like prom, wedding, quinceañera, New Year's events, things like that. We've now branched out past events, but that was like the original concept. You go online, look at our site, choose what style you want, or you go in store and do the same thing. And then we have this fit algorithm that tells you what size you are. We send the suit or tuxedo to you 10 days before your event, so you have enough time to try it on, make sure everything fits, looks good, and then you send it back a couple days after the event. And so it's pretty simple. We make money basically on the rentals, and our business is like a heavy supply chain business because we design and manufacture the suits ourselves, and then it's a heavy logistics business because we have big dry cleaning in both of our facilities on the East and West Coast, because we have to make sure that these things kind of look and fit nicely for the customer.
So how much capital have you guys raised to date, Andrew?
We've raised about $75 million in equity. It's a pretty capital-intensive business.
So I know that the early days, you know, before you guys even launched, you were already knocking on VCs' doors that were not opening. And eventually, when you had some traction, they not only opened, but they were coming after you because they wanted to invest. So what happened there? I mean, walk us through, how has it been, you know, the experience too of raising all that money as well?
Yeah. So when we launched the business, it was 2013. And right before we launched, we were part of this accelerator in LA called Mucker Labs. And what they do is they invest a small amount of money in the business, like, you know, very small amount. But then they help you grow the business. And these guys were fantastic. And before we launched, a lot of people would come by this office and they, you know, talk to all the companies and entrepreneurs, and there was some interest in us. And so we thought, why don't we try to raise money before we launch? And so we put together a pitch deck, et cetera. We went out to all these, mostly Silicon Valley and New York, DC, some in LA as well. But everyone was kind of like, no. Interesting concept. You guys are really young. This is a pretty operationally intense business. Like, let's see what happens. You know, I know it's not really like a fully closed door in the VC world at the early stage. It's like a, hey, let's keep in contact. But it was a no. We weren't able to raise that round. And so we had some like friends and family money and some of the money from Mucker. We launched the business and we got so much traction. We were covered in GQ and the Wall Street Journal. And all these places were saying, like, this is the new way to rent a suit or tuxedo. Gone are the old days where it doesn't fit. It's baggy. You know, you're in a strip mall and things that, like, the customer doesn't really like. And so basically we had a long wait list. We have way more demand than supply. And so we went back to a lot of these investors, and then we had more investors than money we wanted to take in that round. So that was super exciting. It was very early stage and the business was still unproven, but we did a financing with Layer Ventures, First Round Capital, Menlo Ventures, Crosscut, Rain, like a whole bunch of, like, you know, at the time, really good kind of seed stage VCs. And so that was, like I said, a really nice moment coming from a situation that made us want to cry to a situation that made us, like, you know, extremely excited to have the capital to keep running the business.
And then what about, like, the subsequent financing cycles? You know, how did they look like?
Yeah, so they were a little more step function than that. So, you know, we would grow the business. And for the first couple of years, we grew without marketing. I think it was really right timing. Like, we were very fortuitous and lucky in some ways in the timing at which we launched the business. And so, you know, one of our insiders led a Series A, and then we got another group called Stripes in New York to lead a Series B. And then we got another group called TCP in New York to lead a Series C. And so it was just like these subsequent rounds of investment that really were tracking with the growth of the company.
So you were mentioning that you guys started, you know, really doing direct to consumer, and now you have all these different stores, you know, on the West Coast, East Coast. How did the strategy look like, you know, when thinking that through?
Yeah, so when we launched, we were sort of like maybe a little naive, thinking everyone's going to be okay renting a suit or tuxedo online and buying one, because right now we actually sell our suits and tuxedos as well, and we have a lot of traction there. Anyways, so we opened a little, like, showroom in our Santa Monica location because we started finding, like, some people are kind of skeptical of doing this online. They don't know if it's going to fit. Think if it's like a young guy in his 20s and it's one of his first suits, he might not even know what size he is. And so we opened this little showroom in the back office, and this thing was just getting booked like crazy. We put a little, like, you know, book in our Santa Monica location on our website, and so many people were coming in. And then we were like, hey, this makes a lot of sense. We should scale this. And so we opened 5 more of our own. And then to really scale it, like, we'll continue opening more of our own over time, potentially aggressively. But to really scale that opportunity, we partnered with Nordstrom. And there's a funny story there. So originally, when we launched the business, when we were pure online and no offline, we put on our website, like, go to Nordstrom to get measured, because Nordstrom would do free measurements. And we put the Nordstrom logo on there. And a lot of our customers were going in, so many that Nordstrom sent us a cease and desist and basically said, like, you can't put our logo on your website. It looks like you're affiliated with us. And, you know, we understood. So we took it down, which was a little bit of a bummer to us. But then about a year and a half later, I got an introduction to someone on the corporate development team at Nordstrom. And I was telling him this story, like, look, we were driving a lot of people into your store for measurements, and we got a cease and desist. We can't do it anymore, but it would be great to partner. And this person was, you know, really supportive of that idea. And then so we got to meet, you know, people in the Nordstrom family and all this. And the idea became, let's open Black Tux showrooms in the Nordstrom location. So it's not like they're selling our stuff. Like, we actually staff it. We have the employees. It's all appointments. And so that's really how we've scaled the offline experience. We have over 30 Nordstrom locations, and we're opening a few more this year.
Hey, guys. So pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
Obviously, you know, like as part of the journey too, you know, you guys had to go through COVID, you know, and I know that that was not an easy, you know, type of experience, especially for this company that you guys are running. So how was that for you all?
Miserable. Really challenging. Gave me a lot of gray hair. I think at the end of the day, I think important for entrepreneurs to understand that very, very seldom is a business up and to the right for the entire history of the business. It's like a squiggly line that hopefully moves up and to the right. And, you know, that was very much our story. We're in a great place now, but for the first 6 to 7 years, the business grew really nicely. And then we hit COVID. And I remember sitting around the table with the board and people discussing, hey, you know, we're reading this in the paper, and this was like early 2020. Is this a concern for the Black Tux? And we were all like, oh, we're not sure. We don't know. And then fast forward, like maybe not even a month, and it was so bad that, you know, we decided we need to furlough many of our employees. We need to temporarily close all of our stores. We need to do literally everything humanly possible to preserve capital in this environment, because what we were looking at and projecting was like, we were probably going to do 20 to 30% of the revenue that we thought in that year. And that is just such a massive operational challenge. And we were lucky, I think, in some ways, like we saw it quickly, acted very fast. And I give a lot of credit to my team for that. And because we acted fast, we were really able to get to the other side of it. And our idea was, if we get to the other side, we don't want to raise capital during this environment, of course, because we're just going to get hosed. But if we get to the other side, it'll be like a snow globe and the industry was shaken and there's going to be a lot of opportunities and probably a lot of market share to take. And that's what ended up happening. And so we got to the other side, and in 2021, we had way more demand than we could fulfill. And so that was also a really challenging year. But then 2022 and 2023, we've been in a much better place. So it kind of took, I would say, 2 to 3 years out of our business trajectory, which in hindsight is really disappointing. But I really feel like for the team that stayed with me, it was a huge challenge. We got through it together. We were fighting in the trenches. And so it was like kind of a very motivating and rewarding experience to have made it through and now be in a position where we can continue growing the brand.
What was that moment where you were able to take a deep breath and were like, we're going to make it?
Oh, man, that's a good... I don't know that there was like a single moment, because it was so chaotic that even if there was a moment when I took a deep breath, honestly, in the back of my mind, I was so like shell-shocked, thinking like, what's going to happen next? What's the next shoe to drop? Because there was so much, if you remember, there was so much back and forth of like restrictions, vaccine, all these different things. And because our business is so event-focused, like people are using this for social gatherings, we were probably like one of the most affected businesses by the constant back and forth. And so for us, it was like, I mean, I was looking at the news and looking at the reports of cases like every single day, multiple times, trying to figure out what is the future going to hold. And it was impossible to predict. It was probably honestly like after a couple months of good news, then we were like, okay, we can settle down and we can start planning a little bit more for the future with like, you know, more confidence.
So talking about planning and talking about the future, let's say you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of the Black Tux is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Yeah, so we would like to have a lot more stores. So basically the formal wear industry has been controlled by like a couple major retail players for a very long time. And from our perspective, these brands did a great job in the past, but don't do as good of a job now meeting the customer needs and really speaking to the customer in a way that they understand. And it's hard to turn that ship when you have like 30 plus years of brand equity. So our perspective is that's what we want to do. We want to have a large rental business, I think with probably 3 to 5 times as many stores that we have now, but a rental business that also feeds into a sales business. So lately we've started selling a lot of suits and tuxedos and had some success there. And so we'll continue to expand that part of our business because we have these young guys who come to us. It's like the first time they've worn a suit or a tuxedo or even a shirt or a pair of shoes, slacks. And they're like, hey, I really like what you have to offer because we have very high quality garments, surprisingly high quality for the price that we offer. And they're like, can I keep this or can I buy a new one, et cetera. And so it's like a really nice way for them to try out what we have to offer and then buy something later. So, you know, in like 10 years, we'd love to have over 100 locations and a big business in both rent and buy.
So I think that there's one aspect, you know, that that you were alluding to earlier, you know, which is the logistics, you know, of a company like this. You know, they're not easy. As you guys are thinking about, I mean, you have quite a sizable amount of people. How many employees do you guys have today?
We have about 400 employees.
I mean, that's a lot of employees. So I guess in that regard, you know, as you're thinking about execution, as you're thinking about making sure that everyone is rowing towards, you know, the same goal, you know, with the same vision, with the full alignment there, and to make sure that people are capable, you know, of executing for in a business like this, how do you guys think about systems and processes?
Yeah, so I think for me, it starts at the top. It starts with hiring people who know how to do the things that I need them to do. Because for me, I can set the vision, I can bring the capital, bring the motivation, but then the team really has to be experienced enough to know how to do all the things that we need to do to get from point A to point B. So I really want to give a lot of credit to my team. We have a fantastic, very experienced team right now. In terms of processes, I think it's, for us, it's important to like set the vision and then set kind of quarterly goals that are tracking along toward that vision that are very clear with clear deliverables about what needs to happen within that quarter. And that's been kind of hard during COVID because, like I said, it was so chaotic. That's like any quarterly goal just goes out the window. So this is the first year that we're kind of back operating that way because there's less chaos and it's a little more stable. It's still somewhat unstable. But so I really think it starts at the top, then has the right people, and then just has kind of like management processes for goal setting and making sure that, you know, we're moving towards and meeting those goals.
And talking about, you know, people there, I mean, having 400 plus, how do you go to about culture so that it doesn't break when you're scaling, you know, and you're adding so many heads, you know, into this thing?
Yeah, so I think it just has to be very intentional. Like to me, I think of one of the biggest responsibilities I have as a co-founder and CEO is to create a culture that motivates people and is a place they want to be. You know, when I first started the job or even before I started this business, with Patrick, I was like, that would be so fun and so interesting to create a culture that's a reflection of my values and of the things that I kind of really want to see. And it's evolved over time. Like, I think in the early days, the business was like a family. It's like everyone was close friends. But then as the business matures, parts of that are unhealthy and you need it to be like very professional and very kind of goal and results oriented. And so, you know, as the business has changed, the culture has changed. But I think the one thing we've done, it's just been very intentional about what the culture is and if it's changing, communicating how we want it to change, and just kind of spending a lot of time nurturing and cultivating people and relationships.
So you've been at it now for about, you know, almost 11 years. I mean, it's a, I mean, if you put that into the corporate world, that's like 100 years. I mean, it's unbelievable. Crazy. So, I mean, I'm sure a ton of stuff, you know, that you've learned along the way. I guess if I was to put you into a time machine, and I bring you back in time. I bring you back in time to maybe that moment where you were thinking about doing something of your own and maybe you were brainstorming with Patrick what's possible. And let's say you were able to show up right there in front of that younger Andrew and you're able to give that younger Andrew one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I think it would be trust your gut. So for me, I felt like when I first started the business, a little bit of an imposter. Like I didn't study business undergrad. I was way more interested in humanities. I still am. Like I'm more interested in like philosophy and science fiction and things like this in my regular everyday life. So I kind of doubted myself and doubted my intuitions, even as they related to business. But over time, as I've looked at some of the intuitions I had in the past, I realized, oh, those were like really good. And they were coming from a place of logic and a place of strength, but I just didn't trust myself because I didn't have the experience. So looking back, I would just say, trust yourself, and be willing to make decisions kind of from your gut.
Has there been like a moment looking back where you really, you know, trusted your gut and then things ended up working the way that you were hoping for them to work? And what was that?
Yeah, so probably around the brand and sort of like, I really enjoy working with our creative teams on like how we speak to the customer, how the images are, the videos, all those type of things. Early days in the company, we had and still have, but like a very, very talented team working with us on the brand. And so my gut told me that brand was one of the most important things in this space. Like a lot of people said, you should just launch an MVP, like just get something out there and see how customers responded to it. But my gut was like, that doesn't make sense. Like we have to be something that looks excellent. This is somebody's wedding or somebody's prom. It's important. They have to really like feel a lot when they're interacting with our company. And so we spent a lot of time and a lot of money that people encourage us not to spend on doing that. And so that was a moment where I realized, hey, I think a lot of our traction and a lot of our kind of customers using us is coming because they feel a certain way when they come to the business. And because if at the end of the day, like you can buy a t-shirt from 100 different companies or a dress shirt from 500 different companies. Why are you choosing the one that you choose? It's not because of the quality or this and that, because they're most things are like largely similar. I really think it's because of the emotional connection that the company tries to create with you and whether or not it resonates with you. And so that was a moment or kind of like a whole area of the business where I really trusted my gut that it was important and then hired the right team to execute on it.
So, Andrew, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
They can email me. I'm not super active on social. They can email me at andrew@theblackducks.com. I'm happy to chat with anybody.
Easy enough. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
All right. The pleasure is mine. Thank you so much for having me.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.